Tonight on Arena, we track ABBA from Waterloo to world-conquering stardom, and Rhiannon Connolly joins us before her trip to the Corja Festival in Sligo. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Wandering around Ireland or any country in Europe or the world for that matter, you are likely to be assailed by the strains of money, 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 knowing me, knowing you, or take a chance on me. That is how international and popular the Swedish pop group ABBA are and have been for decades. But in Giles Smith's new book, My My ABBA, Through the Ages, he looks back on the time when listening and liking ABBA just wasn't the cool thing to do. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Waterloo, a seminal moment in pop history that saw ABBA burst onto the music scene by winning the Eurovision Song Contest. Giles' book looks at the fashion snobbery, critical judgment and ability of great pop music to transcend all of those things. Before I talk to Giles, let's remind ourselves of that winning Eurovision entry, Waterloo. Waterloo there from ABBA at the 1974 Eurovision. And I'm joined by Giles Smith now, who has written a book about ABBA, My My, ABBA Through the Ages. Giles, you're so welcome.
Hello, Kay. Hi.
Can you recount that moment, that first encounter you had with ABBA on April the 6th, 1974?
Yeah, it's very rare that, isn't it, that you can account exactly for where you were, what you were doing the first time you hear a particular song or a particular group sing. And of course, obviously with ABBA and Waterloo, that was the case. So I was about, I was 12 going on 13 and sitting at home with my parents watching the Eurovision Song Contest. And it's just, I think for my generation, there were kind of two big television moments really. And one was the Apollo moon landings. And the other is ABBA singing Waterloo at Eurovision in 74. I mean, they really were both kind of equivalent in the way that they were impressive, you know, and stayed with you.
They shook your world,
It was just very, very different. I think you have to remember just how boring the Eurovision Song Contest was in the 70s. I mean, it really, nowadays you look at it, it's a complete party, you know, and it's wild and whatever else you want to say about it, it's not boring. But then the Eurovision Song Contest really was tame. You know, most of the songs were ponderous kind of ballads sung by people who looked very serious while they were doing so. And if the songs were upbeat, they were kind of upbeat in a sort of whimsical way. And it just wasn't certain if you were young, it wasn't aimed at you. And, you know, and suddenly here come ABBA with this song that sounded exactly like the kinds of things you were excited about that were in the pop charts. You know, it sounded a bit like T-Rex, Waterloo did, and it sounded a bit like Slade, and it sounded a bit like Sweet, mm-hmm. and all of this sort of glam rock stuff that was going on. And that was completely unusual, and it sort of knocked you back a bit right there and then.
So after you saw them on the Eurovision then, did you pursue them? Did you search out maybe an album or what they were doing? Or did you kind of see them and more or less forget about them?
No, it exactly did work like that. So I went and bought the single, definitely. I mean, here's another strange thing to think about in 1974 was if they hadn't won, the chances of you hearing that song again were really minimal. I mean, the great thing about them winning on the night was they got to play it again that night, so you'd heard it twice. But, you know, there was no kind of, there's no internet that you can go to and look the song up and listen to it again. So it won, and therefore, you know, it was a single, it was released as a single, and I got that single, I remember. But then, of course, the other thing about Waterloo is it's not like anything that ABBA subsequently did. There are actually no, really, there aren't any more glam rock songs in the ABBA catalogue. Waterloo's completely out there on its own. And as they start to release records, every one of them sounds different and moves on. So I did. I eventually bought the 1975, they released an album which was simply called ABBA. And by then, they'd released Mamma Mia, which one had heard on the radio and liked. But of course, Mamma Mia doesn't sound very much like Waterloo.
And do you
every
think
time
they had
they
a
released
grand...
a single, then they...
Sorry, Jazz, did you
Carry
think
on,
they
sorry.
Had... Did they have a grand plan when they went on the Eurovision? Sometimes it's said that they did, you know, that it was just a launch pad for them.
Definitely. I think they saw it as a way of tunneling out. I think they felt stuck where they were. It was very difficult for them in Sweden to get their music out into the world. It was quite tough for a Swedish act to be accepted in Sweden singing in English. I mean, that really was kind of frowned on. And of course, you weren't really going to get your pop music right out into the world unless it was in a language that a lot of people use. So definitely, I think they spotted Eurovision and thought, let's go for that. They'd tried several times before Waterloo. They tried the previous year and failed to get in, to get past the Swedish heats. They'd written songs in the 60s for other people who had entered for Eurovision. I think it was always in their mind as their escape tunnel. But then, of course, they get out through that escape tunnel, but it comes with its own burden, because being the winner of the Eurovision Song Contest is not a particularly kind of cool thing to be.
Yes.
It becomes a bit of an albatross for them, because you are then a Eurovision Song Contest band, and Eurovision Song Contest bands were only ever one-hit wonders. So the plan was great and it worked, but also it backfired. They spent a long time getting over being a Eurovision act and trying to be regarded as something else.
Sorry, Giles, I think the criticism was very cruel. It was visceral, that this kind of, and almost racist in ways, against ABBA.
Definitely. The extent of the slagging off that they get through the 70s until the beginning of the 80s, really, when they stop being a band, is quite extraordinary to read now. And a lot of it has to do with the resistance to pop written by people who don't have English as a first language. And it's as simple as that. And I think you're right to call it racism. They get called Europop a lot in the writing about them in the 70s, or they're a Euro band. You know what I mean? People don't even do them the dignity of according them the Swedishness. You know, they're European in some kind of vague, amorphous way. And definitely in the UK, they suffered for that.
And then you said also that there was, I don't know whether it was criticism, but, you know, people wondered about, you know, two couples in a band. People wondered about, like, the gaudy outfits they wore. That all seemed to work against them.
Yeah, I think so. I think that the couple thing is very interesting, because that's just not what you expect a pop group, or certainly not a rock group, to be. Now, there's nothing rebellious about a band that's made up of two couples. Pop groups were meant to be available in some way, and they really very specifically announced their non-availability by being two couples. So that was certainly something that people found a bit mystifying. And as you say, the costumes, I mean, you have to remember in the 70s, of course, there was a lot of that about. You had to work quite hard to be surprising in the middle of glam rock and wear things that people would go wow at. But they really did push that very hard, it has to be said. I mean, almost any television show appearance that you look back at now with ABBA on, there are like four separate crimes against fashion being committed on the stage at any one time. I mean, they did push that hard, and people... I mean, I think they did it wittingly and actually were probably found it quite funny, but people took them seriously on it and kind of called them out on it, definitely.
So let's listen to a track which I think is your favourite track, and we might just talk afterwards about whether these are very simple songs or complex songs. This is Knowing Me, Knowing You.
Walking through an empty house.
Knowing Me, Knowing You from ABBA, and My My, ABBA Through the Ages is the book that Giles Smith has written about being at times a closeted ABBA fan. Just listening to that song there, and I know it's one of your favourites. You as a young man were a musician, you played piano, and you were working out some of the chords and melodies on those ABBA songs, and they weren't quite as simple as one might think on hearing it first or second time.
They're really not. They're very complex. I think, you know, when you listen now, this is the other thing, is they kind of transcend their time as well. They sound so gorgeous. That song in particular is a favourite of mine just because I think it sounds so amazing. It's really rich and it's lush, and there are odd things going on in the arrangement, even of that song, you know, Knowing Me, Knowing You. The bass guitar, if you listen to it, the bass guitar is actually playing the melody line that the vocalists are singing, which is a very odd thing to do. It's not instinctively what a pop song would do. It's full of this kind of brightness and richness and depth, which they obviously worked very hard to achieve. And I think is one of the reasons the songs survive so well, because very often songs will have a sound in them that just immediately makes you think, oh, that's an 80s record, or oh, that's a 70s record. And it's quite rare that you feel that about an ABBA track. They just kind of float free. They're not like anybody else's, I suppose, either, is the other thing. They don't sound like anybody else's songs. But they are very... The melodies are complex. The harmonies are extraordinary. The force of the singing is very easy to overlook. I think from a distance, you can think of ABBA as being quite soft. But if you actually listen to the power with which those two female voices blend and come at you out of most of the mixes, very true of Knowing Me, Knowing You, that's always quite surprising and quite startling. They're much kind of harder and firmer than they get credit for.
Now, Giles, you were talking there about the enthusiasm you felt when you saw them first and then buying their first records. But then, you know, it became a kind of thing of shame to be an ABBA follower, and you experienced that very acutely.
You definitely had to hide it. And the trouble is that, you know, they coincide with punk and new wave. And at that point, really, they're pretty much washed away. In turn, there's no chance they're going to be cool. I had the cassette of the album I mentioned before, the album called ABBA that came out in 75, and I can remember turning that over so that in the box in which I kept my cassettes, you just see the blank back of it in case anybody should actually come round from my friends and see it. I mean, they were that sort of, they were that embarrassing to like. It's very hard to reckon with now when they're so popular and everybody is completely relaxed about the fact that ABBA are good. But back then it was a little bit harder to carry a torch for them, definitely.
And you think that the great turnaround happened with the release of their greatest hits in 1992, which is so much later, almost 20 years after Waterloo.
I think that is kind of the watershed moment. It slowly builds. Here's the other really interesting thing about ABBA. They've been around for 50 years, but for 42 of those years, I mean, 42 of those years, they haven't really been a band. You know, they stopped doing what they were doing in 1982, they gave up recording and touring. They hadn't done much touring anyway. But so they just kind of slipped off the radar and sat at home. And at the point at which they stopped in 82, they were probably as unfashionable as they'd ever been. You know, the 80s were coming, and the 80s kind of swept them away for a while. But then slowly the music comes back, and it is all about the music. It's not about them. It's just the fact that these songs kind of stuck around, and the ABBA Gold album comes out and people start to listen to it again. And then a whole new generation discovers it, and various things happen. Benny and Bjorn appear with U2 suddenly in 1992 on stage. U2 kind of invite them on as guests. So that's kind of an interesting moment for their reputation, because you wouldn't put those two together. There's just suddenly a sense that, hang on, these songs are really good and they survive and they're worth holding on to. People's attitudes to the songs change as time goes by. And it's weird because it's got nothing to do with ABBA themselves. As I say, they're just sitting at home in Stockholm, watching it happen.
And you're also a fan of their show, the Voyager show.
Yeah, I think it's an extraordinary thing. I was, again, like so much with ABBA, you kind of were skeptical going in. You know, I wondered what this thing was going to be. People talked about it as a hologram show. It's not actually a hologram show. It's a film. In fact, it's an incredibly clever three-dimensional film. But, the whole notion of the hologram show is kind of naff and ghoulish, and you know, when it's been tried in the past, it's not worked at all. So what, you know, you go along to the ABBA show thinking, what on earth am I going to see here, the show in which the band aren't actually appearing? And yet it's amazingly emotionally involving. I mean, it's very beautifully done, for one thing. It's very very beautiful to look at, but also the songs play and suddenly, you know, you get caught up in it. It's an extraordinary thing.
Well, you have whetted our appetite for the hologram show and going back to our ABBA collection. My thanks to Giles Smith. My, ABBA Through the Years is published by Gallery Books. And more literature now, of a bit older variety, but very revitalised tonight. The writer Oliver Goldsmith is mainly remembered for his novel The Vicar of Wakefield, the poem The Deserted Village, and the comedy drama She Stoops to Conquer. This is the 250th anniversary of the death of the Longford-born writer, wanderer, bon viveur and bard. In association with the Goldsmith Festival, the actor Michael James Ford has written a new play about his eclectic life called The Misadventures of Oliver Goldsmith. I'm delighted to be joined now by the cast of the play, writer and actor Michael James Ford, the actor Sinead Murphy and Ben Waddell. You're all very welcome.
Thank you.
So Michael, The Misadventures of Oliver Goldsmith, and he had some exciting, misadventurous life. Bring us back to those early childhood days.
It's important to remember that he's very much an Irish writer, and he grew up, he was the son of a very poor parson who famously lived on £40 a year. And the family had great hopes for him, and all their hopes were constantly thwarted because he had an extraordinary capacity to mess up. So there were different... One time he was going to go into the church.
You said bright and a blunderer, I think.
Exactly.
Is that right? Yeah,
he had two natures,
heady mix.
Two natures, one bright, the other blundering. And he only really, so he had this topsy-turvy education, both at primary school, and when he went to college, Trinity College, and of course there's the great statue of him outside Trinity. But he had a very undistinguished academic career at Trinity.
Now, people often liked him and tried to help him, like his early teacher, Thomas Byrne. He filled him with notions of adventure.
Yeah. And people really seemed to love him. And as you say, wanted to help him. He had this extraordinarily open, benevolent personality. But they also recognised that he was amazing when he wrote things down. Not so great when he talked, which became a problem when he got in with the London wits later in his life.
Yes, and he went to Trinity College, but he didn't go as a proper student. I mean, he was a student, but he kind of had to pay for his keep.
That's right. He was because his father was so poor. He went as a sizer or poor scholar, and he had to do all sorts of sweep out the yard and bring the opulent fellow students their dinners. And he really didn't like the fact that he... What's the outfit he wears, Ben?
Yes, a coarse gown and a plain black cloth cap without a tassel. And without a tassel seems to be the worst thing.
Yeah, the lack of tassel was definitely the worst thing, I think.
So we're going to play, and you're going to perform. I'm not going to play. You're going to play an extract now from the play. Michael, will you set it up?
So this little scene is after his childhood and his studies. He's gone off. He studied medicine and he's gone off to complete his medical. He studied medicine in Edinburgh and he's gone off to complete his studies on the continent. But all he really wants to do is travel and see Europe. And he doesn't have a penny in his pocket. He just has his flute. And essentially he busks his way around Holland, Belgium, France and Italy. And then he runs out of money, and his main benefactor back home has died, and he heads back, heads for London. And when he arrives, he's completely broke. And this is how it begins. In the dismal month of February in 1756, Oliver Goldsmith found himself launched on the great metropolis of London, or rather, drifting about its streets without shelter or sustenance, and with but a few pence in his pocket.
The first authentic trace we have of him in this new part of his career is filling the situation of an usher to a school. And even this employ he obtained with some difficulty after a rigorous interrogation.
Have you been bred apprentice to the business?
No.
Then you won't do for a school. Can you dress the boy's hair?
No.
Then you won't do for a school. Can you lie three in a bed?
No.
Then you will never do for a school. Have you a good stomach?
Yes.
Then you might indeed do for a school.
So I was given the situation. But in all truth, I had rather be a prison turnkey in Newgate. Every trick was played upon me. The oddity of my manner, my dress, and my language was a fund of eternal ridicule. And I was obliged to sleep in the same bed with the French teacher, who disturbed me for an hour every night in papering and filleting his hair, and stank worse than a carrion with his rancid pomatums when he lay his head beside me on the bolster.
Bonne nuit.
That's Ben Waddell, Sinead Murphy and Michael James Ford performing there from Oliver Goldsmith's play, which is called... what's it called?
The Misadventures.
The Misadventures of Oliver Goldsmith. So we'll misadventure him off to London now. And London is a happening place. This is the London of Hogarth, like the Rake's Progress, yes, and all of that. So it's a fiery time. Joshua Reynolds, Johnson, the great diarist, is there. So, but he's poor as a church mouse, presumably.
He's poor as a church mouse, and he takes a long time to get going. And he has great faith in his abilities as a doctor. But
one of the things he did was medicine.
Yeah,
it's questionable how much he learned.
Yeah, but we later learn that, he actually does an exam later in the play and he's completely disqualified. He fails on every count. But he does practice for a while and... he's still struggling to live, and he starts to get work as a very lowly way in the world of publishing. It was a time of, there was a huge market for books, and it was a time where booksellers were essentially publishers, and they would turn out all kinds of things. They could be philosophical tracts, they could be histories, they could be stories, and he got a job just correcting, reading and correcting the press. And then he started to write things, but it was anonymous. And in fact, the first thing that he wrote that bore his name was a great poem called The Traveller, which was all about his journey round Europe. And he was absolutely thrilled that finally something he'd written bore his name. But it was round this time also that he was adopted by Dr. Johnson, and he became a member of Johnson's famous literary club that featured Edmund Burke and Joshua Reynolds and...
And of course, Johnson was a famous raconteur, whereas, of course, your friend Goldsmith was not.
Yeah, yeah. As they say, the misfortune with Goldsmith is he goes on without knowing how he is to get off in conversation.
So will we have the other extract now from the play? This is to go into his medical career. Would that be right,
Well,
Michael?
He's done all sorts of things and he's had work published, but he has this ability. He always lives beyond his means. So as soon as something goes well, he gets a new pad, he gets new clothes, he gets new furniture, and he's in debt again. So he sees on one of the occasions when he's struggling, he thinks the best thing to do is to return to his medical career. And here we go. Goldsmith continued to live beyond his means, and ignoring the matter of his earlier disqualification, decided to resume his medical career.
But he quickly grew tired of the duties of his profession and of attendance on sick chambers and capricious patients.
Mrs. Sidebottom, you have a fever which necessitates careful management. You must take 4 spoonfuls of James's restorative powder 3 times a day.
4 spoons?
4 spoons? Is that not an excessive dose?
Excessive?
Why, no. The good apothecary errs on the side of caution.
With good cause. These powders are a compound of antimony and phosphate of lime and must be taken in moderation. 1 spoon a day is the recommended limit.
1 spoon?
No, no, 4 spoons. I am the doctor.
The doctor?
You are a quack, sir.
A quack?
And you, sir, are a meddling mixture grinder. I am determined henceforth to leave off prescribing for friends.
Do so, my dear doctor. And whenever you undertake to kill, let it be only your enemies.
Damn your impudence, sir.
Undertake to kill?
And damn your incompetence.
I think now I'm with the apothecary there. I don't think I'd let him near me. That is from The Misadventures of Oliver Goldsmith with Ben Waddell, Sinead Murphy and Michael James Ford there playing the parts. So then he wrote The Vicar of Wakefield. Did that get great success?
It did, but he'd sold, when he was heavily in debt and he was about to be evicted by his landlady, he sold the rights to the book for £60. Just to get out of that particular problem. So he never made any money out of that.
Michael, tell us the story of She Stoops to Conquer, because it was something that happened himself and he put this in, really, it's the ruse within the play.
Yeah, and it's a true story when he was just left school and he was returning home 20 miles from Edgeworth's town to his father's home. And he decided, a friend lent him a guinea and he got a horse and he suddenly felt like the independent traveller. And he arrives at an inn. Oh, he doesn't arrive at an inn. He arrives at the little village of Ardar. And a local character is...
That'd be me.
...regaled by Goldsmith, who says...
Yeah.
Who says?
tell the story.
Yeah. No, he meets this character and the character decides to completely wind him up and says, see that gaff over there now, that big mansion, sure, that's gorgeous, isn't it? That's the best hostel we have around. I work there myself. Sure, they'd be delighted for you to go and stay there in that hostel, which it isn't. So off he goes thinking he's staying in a hostel.
Ends up makes a total fool of himself, essentially. He treats the owner of the big grand house like a landlord, like a servant. And everything is explained to him the following morning over oatcakes. And he feels incredibly embarrassed and ashamed. And then he put it in the play.
Yes, She Stoops to Conquer was on at the Abbey recently. And it's great. It's such fun. It's such comic, timing and fun. Just that these foolish people being made to feel that they're in an inn where they're actually...
Yeah, but I think that was his genius, really, was to take all these mistakes and blunders that he'd made in his own life and to turn them into that wonderful comedy.
He was very much... He was like a man-child. He was sort of this wide-eyed innocent who loved playing games. He was also a big gambler, but he loved playing party games and singing. He was a great singer, and the show features a number of songs, including the famous Three Jolly Pigeons, which gets a lively rendition, and the famous elegy on the death of a mad dog. Yeah. So it's full of music. Sinead provides the most glorious soundtrack throughout. So we have a little mini orchestra on stage.
There's an underscoring for a lot of it and a lot of hilarious songs also.
And can we ask how he ended up? Did he stay in London or did he come back to Ireland?
He never came back to Ireland. Mm. He stayed in London. He moved around a bit in London, but he didn't look after himself. There's a really sad story at the end when his friends... just realise he's killing himself with his endless carousing, his feasting. He's not well. And he invites Dr. Johnson and Joshua Reynolds to dinner. And he produces all these magnificent dishes and they just turn their backs and refuse to eat them because they know he's just doing himself such harm. And it's a very sad end to his life. And he also, the James's powders referenced in that little medical scene, he also firmly believes that these will cure anything. And you know, medical experts reckon that that's one of the things that killed him, was his addiction to James's powders.
Did you find him frustrating, Ben, or did you find him great fun to play?
Very fun. It's a great part. Like Michael said, he's a clown in a weird way. Do you know what I mean? A genius, but then also all of these stories about him and kind of his constant failing in all aspects of his life is enormous fun to play. And then, but people just adored him as well. Everyone talks about how wonderful he was, and he just seemed to be a really benevolent character. So it's great fun. It's not frustrating. I don't know what it says about my casting as an actor, but
you're so perfect for the part, Ben.
Yeah. And I suppose now we would have more sympathy for him as a character, you know, about these trials. I mean, he must have been under great anxiety or you know, psychic pain.
Yeah. And Sinead, I mean, you...
Oh, God, my amateur diagnosis, yeah, at the risk of offending the entire literary academic world. I do have a theory that Goldsmith at least had ADHD and possibly was on the spectrum as well. He just has such a roller coaster of emotions, and he's so easily distracted by the next great thing, whether it's a job in India or a trip to the continent or, you know... and then he's down in the depths. When he's down, he's very down. And when he's up, he's so up and happy and everything's amazing. So, yeah, it's kind of very entertaining to be around, but possibly not so much to be inside that.
What's really interesting is his writing. For a long time, he seemed to have viewed it just as a side hustle. Like it was all about what's the next harebrained scheme to make me rich. And the writing's just, you know. And the writing is extraordinary, but that's off to the side.
Well, it sounds a fascinating night at the theatre. My thanks to Michael James Ford, Sinead Murphy and Ben Waddell, who are all appearing in The Misadventures of Oliver Goldsmith this weekend in the James Joyce Centre in Dublin. For further information, go to jamesjoyce.ie. With Shannos and folk music in her blood, Rhianna Connolly is blending her passion for the traditional Irish folk with influences from all over the world. Voted BBC Radio 2 Folk Singer of the Year in 2020 and nominated for the RTÉ Folk Awards Best Original Track for her collaboration on Not Your Fight with the Henry Girls, she has released 3 albums with Peter Gabriel's label Real World Records, and her vocals features on his new album I.O. The Armagh-born Manchester living singer, flautist and songwriter is back in Ireland this month for the Corja Festival in Sligo, where one of her projects, Rhianna Connolly and Honeyfeet, will be performing as part of their They Want What You've Got tour. She joins me now from Manchester. Rhianna, you're so welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll get into all those various musical projects I've name checked there in a moment. But first, tell us a little bit about Rhiann Connolly and Honeyfeet. You have called the sound wonky pop.
Aye, well, it's been many things. I suppose it's just a reflection of everybody that we have played with throughout our time together. We've been together for about 15 years, and with me and my partner Alice Davis at the helm, and we have released about 5 records now. We're currently on a label called We Are Stardust, and we put out our latest album, It's Been a Wild Buddy,
right,
in 2022. And so we've been really busy.
We're going to play a track from that called Work It. Will you talk us into that?
I suppose for me, it's been a reflection of accessibility as a woman in music and as a mother. And we are a family band. We've been together a long time, and some of us have kids, some of us don't, but we are all raising our children together, and it's pretty tricky, and I don't know how to work it just yet, is I suppose what the song started off as, because I suppose I find it pretty tricky balancing everything out. And if I didn't have the village and everybody, I don't know where I'd be. Well, let's, but then that's a universal one, isn't it?
Well, listen to Work It. There's a great tempo change in this track. Mm-hmm. That's Rhiannon Connolly and Honey Feet there. And the track was called Work It from their album It's Been a While, Buddy. It sounds like you had great fun in studio there, playing with the dynamics and the intros and then looping on all these wonderful effects.
Yeah, I remember writing the album so vividly because it was in that lockdown period, and we had our studio. We'd built a studio in an industrial unit, and it was huge, and we were all in a massive circle facing each other, and we had to be so far apart from each other.
Yes.
And the baby was in the middle of the room, and we had a sort of like a little tent made for Maha in the middle, and was all kind of writing around her, and it was a beautiful time. It was such a surreal time looking back on it, but because we had each other, and we only had each other, it made it really intense, and the album was born from love and desperation, I think.
It was an intense time for you. It's when you became a mother yourself, and then shortly after that you lost your father, Trela, which must have been very difficult for you.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing about losing Daddy is that we both knew it, but we didn't speak of it. We only had this knowing with each other, and like I was very close to him. He was my best friend, and he was going out as she was coming in. So there was this terrible feeling of, I don't want my baby to feel my grief. But of course, when you're expecting, I don't know if all mothers feel this, but I was pretty sure she could overhear my thoughts. So it was like pushing a balloon underwater, and my grief had to go somewhere. So when it did come out, it was quite explosive, you know, it was a reckoning.
Your father, like so many in your family, was a great musician himself.
Mm-hmm.
A piper and a singer.
And a Shanachie, and Cribog. He was in the Armagh Pipers Club, and he was a fantastic poet. He's a beautiful book of poetry called The Picasso Shirt that I read from all the time, and he wrote a lot of work in the H Blocks. He was a teacher, he was a philosopher. And I think a wonderful Shanachie singer. Tarla Connolly is a bit of a rock and a lake for all of us. He has six children who still write poems for him and sing songs for him all the time, you know.
Now, another song you wanted to talk about was Border Bodies. Again, it shows, it plays to your musicality, but also to issues that you're profoundly interested in.
I think I think growing up in our house, you know, with my father being in Loncash, my mother was from Manchester, and we didn't recognise the border in our house, and that's just, you know, I live in Manchester now, and I openly talk about, you know, monarchy, a feeling that. That it is immoral and that every man is equal under the plough. And then I work with displaced communities and communities on the periphery, marginalised communities. And I think reading the news now, or just engaging with the world, is such a harrowing thing that it almost strikes you as too much to talk about. And so it's really important for me to keep on having that conversation, that it's not impolite for you to disagree, as long as you are open to listening to each other. And I think we get overwhelmed in grief and we get kind of frozen in fear of engaging with it with each other. So I think with border bodies, at the time I was talking about even prison, and I was thinking about Palestine, and that was 2 years ago, you know. And even now, it kind of it makes me kind of, I suppose, sit with what my people would have thought of what's going on now. Because it's always been something that, if you think about human rights and humanitarianism, you have to belong to a place to avail of the human rights of that country. But if that country does not exist, then how do you exist? You know, it's about biopolitically qualified life.
Let's listen to Border Bodies.
Gave you all of themselves. Ones that visit in our sleep. And we walk over them still.
That's Border Bodies.
Rihanna, you were in the Manchester folk scene. It seems like a very a great scene for cross-pollination of ideas and being able to get to work with anybody you wish to work with in that scene.
I suppose the first word would be that it doesn't work at all. I think it is a vast community. Manchester is full of little pockets of gold. You know, the diaspora of Ireland is older, I suppose, in the north of Manchester. And a lot of my family would have moved there first and then moved a bit more south Manchester. And I've still got a load of far-off cousins around there. But it's mostly run by women. All of the session scenes and all of the teaching is done by women. So it's a very matriarchal kind of community. And there are sessions and places that are welcome for people every day of the week here. And it's really nice that you don't have to be an amazing musician to be welcomed at the table. And it is very much a sort of a kitchen table sort of feeling. And for me, I've been very, very lucky to have that always as a backup of somewhere, like a well to go back to and a safe space. And I think we've worked really hard to keep it safe, a safe space for everybody to come to, you know.
And Honey Feet, you nod to sounds of the blues and the funk. Are you getting all of those kind of sessions in the Manchester scene, or is that about other listening and other travelling you do?
Excuse me, but I think Manchester is a cosy city. Like, it is a big city, but it's still quite small once you've been here for a while. And I've been here 21 years, you know. So I don't gig Irish gigs over here. I do Irish sessions. So when I was studying critical theory, and I started doing jazz gigs, actually. So I was welcomed into the jazz circuit. And then I was living in amongst African and Caribbean communities. So I was going to jam nights in places that had people from all over the world. And I think then when I started working in refugee and migrant community houses, I just went to the oldest person in the room for the best story. And that's where you get the best songs. So it was natural that I was going to want to hear songs in, you know, Amharic and Sudanese and Nuba and in Arabic and, you know, in French and Lingala and Zulu and, you know, all Tigrinya. Like, there's so many amazing languages in the communities here that It's sort of addictive once you start kind of truffle pegging around is how I like to describe my archive hunting. Is that I just want to hear it all, because for me languages are notes. It's a note system.
Well, Rhiannon Connolly, the Corja Sligo Festival will be able to hear you and Honey Feet on Saturday the 6th of July. That's the Corja Arts Festival, which will run from the 6th to the 13th of July 2024, with more information on their website, corjafestival.com. And Rhiannon Connolly, thank you so much for talking to us. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Barbara Rosanwu. Liam Mullen and Jamie Doyle are on sound. Ali Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Therese Kelly, and John Creedon is next after the news at 8.